The top topics. The headiest headlines. The debatiest debate. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Happy Saturday. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Annis alongside Craig Battle and Jeff Simmons this week. Lots to get to on today's program. Blue Jays spring training rolls right along, even though we got more than 2 weeks left in it before the regular season starts. We may know who will start opening day. Is Mike Wilner maybe dropping some bombs yesterday on Sportsnet.ca. We will also talk about the Toronto Raptors and their inconsistent play, which is kind of a positive spin on what's gone on the last couple of weeks. March Madness, well underway as well. Bunch of 14 seeds winning on first day of the Madness. Guy falling out of his chair. Buzzer beaters, all kinds of stuff. And maybe we'll get to Chris Borland, the former San Francisco 49ers linebacker who retired. And Milos Raonic as well with a huge win over Rafa Nadal at Indian Wells yesterday. But we start, gents, in the NHL, and no, we will not start with the Maple Leafs, although we may touch on them at some point in this opening segment. But the story of the last couple of weeks, and maybe now when we look back at this season, the story of the entire season in the NHL, the Hamburglar in Ottawa, Andrew Hammond, yet to suffer a regulation loss in his NHL career, 12-0-1. Finally did have a game where he gave up two goals or more, but it came in a 6-4 win over the Boston Bruins in the biggest game for either team this season. They're now just 2 points back that final playoff spot in the Eastern Conference, and they have a game in hand. What do we make of all of this, Jeff? It's crazy. It's insane. It's beautiful, really. It's what makes sports so great.
It's funny because like a month ago, I remember looking at the standings, seeing Ottawa was only 2 points up on Toronto, and no one was really talking about them, and they seemed so irrelevant at the time. And then Hammond comes out of nowhere, and all of a sudden, they're 2 games back of a playoff spot, and I think they've won 13 of their last 15 games, and Hammond didn't allow more than 2 goals in his first 10 starts. And a good goaltender, you see how valuable that is, because the team was just floating in circles, and they're going nowhere. And then all of a sudden, this guy comes out, and they could be a playoff team. And that's crazy to say. I never would have considered Ottawa. They were supposed to be in the lottery a couple months ago.
Yeah, they've got a 5-game win streak going. And over that, he's got a .945 save percentage, which is actually off his season save percentage of .950. It's an absolutely insane run.
It doesn't make any sense on a number of different planes. One of them is that it's not like he was lighting the AHL on fire. He had a sub-900 save percentage in the American Hockey League, and then he makes the leap to the NHL. And there are guys, I mean, in baseball, you'll have players who don't have great minor league numbers. They make the leap to the major leagues, and for whatever reason, their numbers go up. I don't think we see that very often in the National Hockey League, where guys are journeyman pros. They're not highly touted prospects. The guy's 27 years old. He's getting his first taste of being a starter in the National Hockey League. And it begs the question, Craig, when we see, I mean, it's not a one-off either. We've seen it happen with Hutchison in Winnipeg. We've seen, you know, James Reimer kind of came out of nowhere too. We've seen goalies come out of nowhere. Is there too much importance? Do teams put too much importance on getting an established number one goalie when you can see plenty of instances where guys just come out of nowhere?
I don't know about that. I mean, obviously you want the sure thing. Like, you want the assuredness of having a guy that you can trust night in and night out. But I think you can't discount the fact that players like Hammond can catch lightning in a bottle, and you always got to be on the lookout. Because Craig Anderson is no slouch in net, and he's injured now. And the fact that they've got Hammond in their back pocket is pretty amazing. But I don't think this happens enough that you can be like, okay, yeah, we're just going to go goalie by committee. You know, like we're gonna hope one of these guys figures it out. Yeah, like you want a Craig Anderson there, and then you're just thanking your lucky stars when Hammond blows up.
What do the Senators do now? Because they've got three goalies. They've got Andrew Hammond. He's been unbelievable, and you're obviously going to ride him this season to wherever he takes you, whether that's to the playoffs or whether now it's a spectacular collapse or whatever. But they're 2 points out of the playoffs, and we're looking at 12 games left in the regular season. So that's this season. That's all well and good. But Robin Leonard and Craig Anderson are still under contract for a couple more seasons. Leonard's a restricted free agent in a couple years, and Craig Anderson, I believe, has 3 more years on his deal before he's a UFA. What do you do with this guy? Because I mentioned it's not like you have a pedigree to go back on and you say, well, this was expected. It's completely out of nowhere. He could easily turn back into a pumpkin, Jeff. What do you do if you're the Ottawa Senators and you got 3 goalies?
You get McDonald's to pay his contract.
Yeah. It was great watching Curtis Lazar eat one of those hamburgers right off the ice. I don't know if I'd do that. It's amazing how the hamburgers are staying in one piece when they hit the ice. Pickles intact.
Does the 5-second rule apply when something hits the ice?
I don't know. I don't know. There could be blood on the ice. Do you really want to eat a hamburger right off the ice? Seems unwise.
If you threw a burger in the newsroom and threw it on the ground.
Absolutely no chance I'm touching a hamburger that touches
the
newsroom.
But how many people would?
Yeah, I don't know. On the radio side of things, probably lots.
Does the wrapper count? It was in a wrapper.
Yeah,
so,
that's true.
I mean, you know, but Jordan Heath Rawlings pointed out on Twitter that someone could have spit in it and thrown it on the ice. So,
I think I have a little more faith in the human race than to default go to someone spitting in the hamburger.
I don't know. He said it might have been a Bruins fan. So, we don't know.
But what do you do if you're the Senator? So, you got these 3 goalies. You got this one who's gone on an incredible run. It's a small sample size when you're talking about a season, but it's not that small. We're talking about 13 games. I mean, that's a good portion of a season to put up a save percentage of .950. But you've got Craig Anderson and Robin Leonard who have done it a little more regularly and have a little more pedigree. What do you do, Craig? I mean, you're the Senators. You're happy that this has happened, but it's opened a whole other can of worms.
I think this is essentially what the Canadians were going through a bunch of years back when they had Halak blow up over that playoff series.
Yeah.
Right? He was absolutely insane. He carried
single-handedly beat the Capitals.
Yeah. Did he get them all the way to the Eastern Conference Final, or was it just slightly shy of that? But anyway, he had an amazing run, and they had to choose in the offseason and wound up trading him. But they traded him for a decent haul, and then they obviously kept the right guy, right? Like, they kept a guy that has turned into one of the top five goalies in the NHL.
And you could give him a sort of a bridge deal, kind of approve it. Here's not too much money that you didn't prove enough of a sample. So here's a small deal, prove it again, and we'll give you another big deal. And I don't see where the Senators throw out a ton of money at him, or I don't know if there's going to be crazy demand for him, because goalie's such a volatile position in general. And goalies just come up and down all the time. It's almost unexplainable. And a guy like Hammond could just be caught lightning in a bottle and could just come back down to earth next year. So I think from the Senators' perspective, really all you can do is kind of hope you can get that again and maybe give him a 1-year short-term restricted deal and ask him to prove it again. And then if he does it again, then maybe you got a guy here.
I think at the very least you're playing from a position of strength where you've got 3 guys who can produce, and then you can go into camp next year with 2 of them, you know, find out what the trade market is for the other guys. I think, yeah, you probably want to keep Anderson, but between Lehner and Hammond, whoever has a better sort of market in the offseason, and then you just sort of grab some picks or a player who can come in and help you on the blue line or the forward.
What does it say about the Boston Bruins? They've now lost 3 straight. They're getting older. Zdeno Chara is not 25 anymore. He's clearly the linchpin of that team, and they struggled mightily without him when he was injured earlier this season. You had a couple of franchise goal scorers that went through your system. I mean, Tyler Seguin's tearing it up in Dallas. The Stars aren't any good at all. Phil Kessel, you get a couple of picks, obviously, and that's worked out not horribly, but it's a lot. I kind of find similarities between that and what the Canucks have done, watching a couple of good goalies go through their system and continue to do well other places. Instead of goalies, it's goal scorers in Boston. Is this kind of the beginning of the end of, I don't want to call it a dynasty. It's been too quick for the Bruins to call it a dynasty, but clearly some very good seasons there, and they're still in the playoff picture, and you would still give them a puncher's chance in the Eastern Conference with Tuukka Rask. But is there concern there, Jeff, when you're talking about the Boston Bruins?
I think there has to be. For me, I was always wondering how they would do when Chara started to decline, because he was such a big part of that team, and there's no one really like him. And they got some good player. Dougie Hamilton's a really good young player. Torrey Krug, they just signed. But Chara's just kind of the backbone of how they play, that tough physical defensive style. And when he started to decline in the team, you saw it in the playoffs last year, they weren't that great. And then now they're hanging on by a thread. And they got some injuries right now too, but I think they're going to really regret that Seguin deal. And I think that's going to have some ripples, because they don't really have that elite scoring type of player. Patrice Bergeron is great, but he's not that elite scorer. And I think they're happy with the Kessel trade. I think look what he's become in Toronto. And I think they kind of saw that coming. They know he's talented, but there's so much that comes with him. But Seguin was a young guy. I think they gave up on him too early. The return was okay, but to give up a guy like Seguin on a team that doesn't have an elite scorer, I think that's going to really, really hurt them down the road, especially when Chara really starts to slow down or when he retires.
Yeah, there were things outside of hockey that probably led to Seguin leaving Boston. I don't know if he's curtailed that or he's just still able to put up points while still, doing the extracurricular things in Dallas. But it's hard to argue with 63 points in 61 games and 32 goals.
And you wonder, though, if the Bruins aren't going to find a situation where they want to work through those issues. Obviously, yeah, like I'm not in that locker room. I don't know what the Bruins front office knew about Seguin. But at what point do you try to sort of reclaim one of these hyper-talented players? Like Seguin's great. You know he has the potential to be fantastic. But he goes out too much. He has some behavioral issues that you're not super excited about. So at what point can't you just sort of start working with him or a mentor or something, like have a veteran leader, really take him under his wing and say, this is how we perform. This is, how we, keep things cool during the regular season.
And, they could have a new GM in the next few years. So their whole perspective of the organization might change. They might have a new coach. If they don't make the playoffs this year, I don't think the GM and the coach are coming back.
Yeah, it's hard to be upset, though, if you're a Bruins fan, because flags fly forever, and they have that cup in their back pocket, and they have another final as well to go along with it. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis, alongside Craig Battle and Jeff Simmons. Let's look out west for a second before we get to the disaster that is the Maple Leafs for a second and a half. Those Canadian teams still hanging in there. I mean, there's been times, even in the past week, where they've both fallen out of the playoff picture. I'm talking about Calgary and Winnipeg. They're back in it now, and it's the team everybody expected to never fall out ever since they got back into the top eight, into the wild card position, back on the outside looking in. The LA Kings are on 82 points, 2 points back of the Jets for that final playoff spot in the Western Conference. The Jets have suffered an incredible number of injuries to their key players. And the Flames are that team, that pesky team, the most exciting team, really. I mean, is there an argument to be made that they're the most exciting team in all the National Hockey League? We know their goal differential in the third period is the best in the entire National Hockey League. They have more comeback wins than anybody out there. They continue to get it done. They got Johnny Gaudreau scoring a ton of goals. He's up to 20 now. I mean, is this just a cool story? And we're looking at now 11 games left in the regular season, so it's not a situation where they're going to be way on the outside looking in. But how do we handicap their chances to make the playoffs in a very, down Western Conference? Is it fair to say this season, Jeff, that the West is down a little bit? It's still good, and the parity is maybe better than years previous, but I don't know if there's a dominant team, so I would call it down this year.
I think the top four teams are still pretty good.
Yeah.
But in terms of like the depth throughout the whole conference, yeah, it does seem a bit down. Vancouver, Calgary, Winnipeg, Minnesota's become really good lately, but those teams, I don't know if they'd make it in a year where the West is really dominant. San Jose's kind of faltered, and Dallas was expected to be pretty good this year. They that didn't happen at all, and a lot of people predicted this Colorado demise, so Colorado's made a late push there. They got 7 wins in their last 10, but I don't think they're going to make the playoffs. So back to your Calgary stuff, they're extremely exciting. And they're that team this year that defies logic because they get outshot all the time, but they have those third period numbers and people just expecting them to keep falling down, but they work hard and they're that true underdog story. And it might not be a sustainable thing. But
I think they get that it's not sustainable, right? You look at the deadline moves that they made. They did not add pieces thinking that they've got a Stanley Cup contender. They were looking towards the future and happy to get whatever they got this season.
And the incredible thing about them is, I remember Mike Babcock said earlier in the year, the one stat he looks for to determine how good a team it is goal differential. Calgary's fourth in the West in goal differential. They're plus 23. That's a pretty telling number. And all the analytics guys, they've been predicting the demise for a while. And it makes sense what they're saying. You can't win being outshot and not possessing the puck on a frequent basis. But when you're plus 23 in goal differential, that is kind of sustainable and shows that maybe they are better than some of these numbers show you.
Seems like every year, this time of year, we are talking about, oh, how there's one team, two Canadian teams in the playoffs, and what a train wreck, what a disaster that's going to be. And the Stanley Cup is never coming north of the border ever again. I mean, we could have a pretty good Canadian contingent in the playoffs, especially if the Senators make it. If you're looking at Montreal and Ottawa in the Eastern Conference, and then Vancouver, Calgary, Winnipeg in the Western Conference, could be one of those seasons where there's really a lot to pick from if you're a Canadian hockey fan, if you choose to do so, which is kind of always a weird situation if you're looking at Leaf fans deciding to hitch their wagon to just some other Canadian team, Greg.
Sure. I remember back in the Vancouver-Boston final a couple of years ago, I'm from out west. I just assumed everybody out here would sort of jump on, like, just sort of, it boggles my mind that no Canadian team has won the Stanley Cup in over 20 years. You know, it just, it bothers me so much, so that, you know, like, I really just want to see the seal get broken, Canadian team get in there, you know, the balance restored. So I was really cheering for a Canucks victory just to get that done. But all the people I talked to out here were cheering Bruins, just sort of latching onto one style over the other, more so than just who's the Canadian team, and you know, I'll be a good homer. So yeah, I mean, the fact that you could have Vancouver, Winnipeg, and Calgary in that first round, not playing each other either. I mean, Montreal and Ottawa right now, if Ottawa sneaks in, would be facing off in that first round. I feel like that's something that, you know, I think a handful, or like a good percentage of you know, good Canadian fans would get behind.
It almost depends where you live, because if you live in Toronto, and a lot of my good friends are Leaf fans, they would want nothing less. They would hate to see Ottawa or Montreal make a deep run or a Stanley Cup run.
Right.
And if just because they're Canadian, who cares? They'd rather see Nashville or Detroit and see Montreal fall on their face. And if you're from Edmonton, do you want to see Calgary make a deep run because they're the Cinderella story? Probably not.
I guess it also becomes how you define yourself. If you're a diehard Oilers fan, right?
Like, yeah.
You hate the Flames.
You hate the Flames, everything. And most people love them. They're the good underdog story. Who doesn't like that? But yeah. I think Winnipeg is a team everyone maybe would like to see. They haven't been to the playoffs since they moved back there. And mm-hmm. I don't know how many people hate Winnipeg, but most people, if you live in Toronto or if you're in Edmonton, I don't know. I think you'd rather see an American team win than a Canadian one.
Yeah, I don't think it really matters where the team plays. If you support the Maple Leafs in this city, it seems like that is a little bit overblown. It's Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Jeff Simmons and Craig Battle. Let's look at the Maple Leafs for a brief second. We won't spend too much time on them, because really, it's a team that's been so irrelevant from an actual hockey perspective all season long. But they keep throwing themselves into the news. Part of it is, yeah, they play in this market, and there's a lot of eyeballs on them. There's a lot of microphones and a lot of faces down there at practice and postgame, even when they are irrelevant from a hockey perspective. But most recent thing to come out of the Maple Leafs dressing room is the anonymous forward who requested to remain anonymous. Michael Tracos quoted him in the National Post, saying it's pretty screwed up in here. And, I mean, that shouldn't be a surprise, I guess, but it does raise a couple of questions, Craig, when you're talking about this team. Because he's talking about the fact that these veteran players, that the guys that aren't putting in the effort, the guys that keep getting blasted by Peter Horacek and then Jonathan Bernier doing a number on them as well after that San Jose Sharks game, mm-hmm. those guys are still getting playing time. Those guys are still getting the ice time. The Phil Kessels of the world, despite the fact that top line has been atrocious. I don't know if you want to say all season. They were scoring goals at least early in the season, even though their plus-minus numbers and their possession numbers were horrible. But recently, they've been god-awful. They continue to get the 15-plus minutes per game. And why aren't the younger players who are trying to prove themselves and you have nothing to play for, why aren't those guys getting the ice time? Does this anonymous player have a point, Craig?
I mean, if it's in terms of the mood in the locker room, like, you know, like the it's pretty screwed up in there, you know, that sort of thing, you'd assume so at this point in the season. But yeah, why they haven't sort of gone with sort of youth movement in a way, or at least just shuffled the deck a bit. Let's change some things. And I think that's the major gripe with this team over the past 5 years leading up into finally Brendan Shanahan and Dave Nonis saying, okay, yeah, now we're going to, you know, see what happens. We're going to full on blow this team up. Is that the core has been the core for 4 or 5 years and it hasn't been able to produce. So why are you sticking with the same core, even as your season has completely unraveled, you're eliminated from the playoffs? Why not just sort of, hey, we've got a 10 game window to try out some stuff. We'll treat this like, you know, preseason for next year. Let's try some different line combinations. We'll run out some guys a little extra minutes, put guys in different situations, see if we can get anything out of this, you know, like make it worthwhile in some way.
Is there a possibility, Jeff, that they're just afraid that they might mess with the tanking chemistry? You might actually get some guys putting forth a solid effort. You might accidentally win a game.
Yeah, maybe this is coming from up top and they want to keep losing, but it just speaks to everything you hear about the team. And they're just such an unlikable group together. And there's Olli Jokinen was saying similar things, that there's like a depressing mood in the locker room. And it just, it's so strange. It's a strange place to be. And it can't be surprising that Shanahan evaluated the team after 1 year. And he pretty much wants to strip the whole team of their core. And It's not like they're trying to raise up the trade value of a Kessel or Phaneuf. People got the book on them and they're not playing well at all. So that's not helping. Outside of Kadri, who's suspended right now, which young guys are you really trying to develop up front and forward? And they're playing Riley, they're playing Gardner. Who's going to be here that they're trying to develop right now?
I don't know. Maybe there's something in Richard Panik. I don't know. Maybe there's something in Brandon Kozin. But yeah, clearly not building blocks, huge franchise pieces of this team going forward. It is just depressing, though, to watch Peter Horjek after these games and try and come up with something and continue to put his team on blast and Jonathan Bernier getting in on the act right now. And it seems like they're kind of locked into their position in the Connor McDavid sweepstakes, because they're on 60 points with just 10 games to go, 9-point gap between them and the Oilers. So they're not catching the Oilers here with 11 games to go. And they're 1 point back of Carolina, or ahead, depending on how you look at it. But the Canes have 2 games in hand. So it looks like they're pretty much locked into that 4 spot here as we look forward to maybe the most anticipated NHL draft lottery in recent memory. When we come back, the Blue Jays pick up a win over the Rays yesterday in spring training action. Okay, no big deal. Daniel Norris was pretty good in that game, though, as well. Another injury as well. Meisser Asturis hurt. Who knows for how long? Could open the door for Devin Travis and Mike Wilner. Basically giving his 2 cents, but maybe has some information as well. I imagine he does in speculating that Drew Hutchison will get the call on opening day for the Blue Jays in New York against the Yankees. And what does that mean as far as the overall prospects of this team in the starting rotation? We will discuss a little Blue Jays baseball coming up next. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I am Ben Ennis alongside Craig Battle and Jeff Simmons on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's Arden Zwelling.
New Blue Jay Josh Donaldson is one of the best hitting third basemen in baseball. A perennial MVP candidate who has the third highest wins above replacement in the majors over the past 2 seasons. But not long ago, he was a catcher in the Oakland Athletics organization, yo-yoing between the minors and the majors, watching his once promising career pass him by.
I was, I guess you could say, rock bottom.
Right.
And I've hit my entire life, and I was kind of like, what's going on?
Then he discovered the video room. He studied the swings of Jose Bautista, Miguel Cabrera, and Alan Craig, and completely rebuilt his mechanics at the plate. He moved to third base, and suddenly he went from a 4A player to one of the best hitters in the majors.
I felt like I needed to do my research, and I needed to kind of take control of what was going on. Because if I wasn't going to make it to the big leagues, I wanted to be able to look myself in the mirror at night and say, hey, you know, I gave it everything that I could.
Read the full details of how Josh Donaldson reinvented himself and saved his career in the current issue of Sportsnet magazine.
This story and more appears in the latest edition of Sportsnet magazine, available on Next Issue and in the Apple Newsstand.
Sportsnet Magazine live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Jeff Simmons and Craig Battle. The Blue Jays beat the Rays 11-5 yesterday in Port Charlotte. And Daniel Norris, pretty solid. He went 5 2/3, giving up just one earned run on five hits, did have a walk, and struck out five. And there were a pretty good swath of major leaguers on that Rays team yesterday, and some non-major leaguers. Juan Francisco got an at-bat, and he struck out. Three at-bats, actually, as Evan Longoria started the game at third base. Steven Souza was in there, Logan Forsythe, John Jaso. They had some major leaguers in that lineup, and Daniel Norris looked pretty good. Now, the Rays aren't going to be an offensive juggernaut in the American League East next year, but if you're looking for something to go on, this is all we have when it comes to Norris. Jeff, are you ready to pencil him in as this team's fifth starter to start the season?
You absolutely have to. He's been unbelievable so far in the spring, and with Stroman down and he's out for the year, you don't really have too much of a choice. And John Gibbons made it pretty clear this week. He didn't say it specifically, but Aaron Sanchez is going to be in the rotation. He pretty much said it's almost a done deal. And without him, What you need Norris is that guy, and he's been pitching really well, and his command has been better, and that was one of the big things with him. And he only walked one yesterday in 5 2/3, and I think you need right now, you're going to need Estrada in the bullpen, maybe as the long man. And Norris is just he's a really fun pitcher to watch, and he seems like the obvious choice for the fifth spot, and I don't see what other option they really have.
When we're talking about starters, and there's a bunch of young ones with the Blue Jays right now, and nothing's been said officially, but yes, Aaron Sanchez seems like he will definitely be in that rotation. Daniel Norris could be there as well. Drew Hutchison is in there after a pretty good season a year ago, coming off Tommy John surgery, pitching to an ERA of 4.48, but his underlying numbers much better than that. Didn't give up many hits, had a good number of strikeouts as well. And Mike Wilner, with a story on sportsnet.ca yesterday, speculating that Hutchison could be the man to get the ball on opening day in New York against the Yankees. The Blue Jays could have three starters under the age of 24 in this five-man rotation. But, Craig, if you look at a team that is, I don't know if expected to win the American League East is correct, but one of those teams that will compete, and some people are picking them to win the American League East, it'll be tough. The Red Sox, I guess, are the betting favorites to win it. But if you're starting a season with Drew Hutchison, a guy who had an ERA of about 4.5 a year ago, is that great? Is that a sign, a bad sign, a good sign, or should we take nothing from it?
I think it's just sort of a bit of a necessity thing for me at this point. We saw a few years back where, I mean, okay, so in terms of this team, I think, you know, in terms of offseason additions, you got the biggest ones weren't in the starting five. They were Russell Martin. We got Josh Donaldson, Michael Saunders in left field. So we want to basically trot out our best team on opening day. And I feel like Russell Martin behind the plate is who you want there. And then so you don't necessarily want Dickey pitching to him. Because you know, I feel like it's going to take some time. It's opening day. You want your strongest possible batting lineup as well. So you get Russell Martin, you get Drew Hutchison pitching to him, and then Dickey can come out the following day and throw to Toley. It's not the same sort of pomp and circumstance that opening day it has with it, where you're going to want Russell Martin, you know, catching a guy he's not necessarily comfortable with yet. So I feel like Hutchison in that spot is, it's not nearly as ceremonial a thing as it might be in some years.
And it seems, from reading Wilner's piece, it seems matchup based. And
yeah,
Hutchinson, just looking at the schedule, Hutchinson, they want him to pitch in Baltimore. That would be their second series. And using him opening day would allow him to also pitch in Baltimore. So that means you take Burley out of the Yankee series. That's mm-hmm. the opening series. And Burley did not do well against the Yankees at all last year. And Yankee Stadium is the place the Blue Jays have had trouble winning the last few years. So it's not so much that they're using Hutchinson declaring this guy is the number one starter. They're just, it's a matchup thing. They're going to use Dickey in the home opener, and everything that Mike wrote in this piece makes sense. And Hutchinson's a pretty good, I was looking at some numbers yesterday. One number caught me off guard. Hutchinson was in the top 10 in American League in strikeouts per nine innings.
Yeah, he struck out a whole bunch. And you look at, I mean, you can't take everything out of underlying and advanced stats with pitching, but his FIP, which is you try and take the fielding out of it and just look at the things that only the pitcher can control, was much lower than his ERA. It was almost a whole run lower. It was 3.85 a year ago. So maybe he was a little bit unlucky and still had a very passable, if not good, season a year ago. So maybe when you're looking at a guy who would have been the best starter for this Blue Jays team this season anyways, but it does look like he will get the start on opening day, because you want R.A. Dickey to start in the Dome in Tampa as well in that third series of the season for the Blue Jays. I know it's, you know, mostly ceremonial, and it's, I don't know if it means everything, and it is matchup based, the reasoning we're talking about Hutchinson getting that start on opening day at Yankee Stadium. But this has been R.A. Dickey's duty the last couple of years, right? This is, R.A. Dickey was the Cy Young Award winner they went out and got from the Mets. Now, he hasn't been quite his Cy Young self, but he was a good starter last year. People sleep on how good R.A. Dickey was and how reliable he has been, even when he wasn't great, even when he's having rough outings. He's taking the ball every 5 days without question. Do you think there's a bit of hurt for R.A. Dickey, Craig, when you're looking at a guy who's a veteran who probably wants to start opening day at Yankee Stadium? I don't know. Does day two mean a whole lot less than day one? I imagine we won't hear anything from R.A. Dickey as far as being upset. But do you think he's a little hurt by this?
I mean, there's probably a part of him that definitely sort of puts some stock into being the ace on the team and being a former Cy Young winner and being a veteran leader and stuff like that. But I think he's a mature guy. He's been around. He's been one of those guys that was basically out of the league. I think at a certain point, and everything I've read about him, he's certainly grateful for where he is and the things he has. So I feel like missing out on an opening day isn't going to be the thing that really sticks in his craw for all that long. And I think, you know, it is, like you guys said, it's a matchups based thing. Like, and I think that's going to be pretty easy for Gibby to relay down the line to R.A. Dickey, and to have him sort of say, okay, well, yeah, you're not going to get this one, but you're obviously still, major in the plans. It's not like he's shuffling him out of the team. It's shuffling him out of the opening day slot, which isn't that big a fall.
And maybe if Stroman was healthy and they said, this is the new number one guy, this is our new ace,
yeah.
Maybe Dickey would be a little upset with that.
That would be a statement.
Yeah, this is more matchup-based, and it's a lot easier of a sell from John Gibbons' standpoint, rather than saying, we're not giving you the opening day start because we don't think you're the ace anymore. So they want to get him in the best situation possible, and why not do that?
Yeah. One of the big position battles this spring training, well, the biggest story going into spring training was definitely that fifth starter spot. After we figured that Aaron Sanchez is going to be in that rotation because Marcus Stroman is out for the entire year, it was who's going to make that start every fifth day. And it appears now it's Daniel Norris. One of the questions, I mean, the secondary question, maybe the third question, was who's going to play second base. Meiser Restore seemed to have the inside track on that job after missing a whole lot of last year, after falling down the dugout steps. He's owed $3 million this year in guaranteed money, last year of his deal, and a switch hitter, and performed okay before he got hurt last year. Now, he's gone down yesterday, had a bit of a groin strain, groin issue, and we don't know how long he's going to be out for, but it opens the door for Devin Travis, a guy they picked up from the Tigers for Anthony Gose, a guy who's hit in the minor leagues, never hit above double A, though, has come into spring training, went 0 for his first 11, I think. Now he's hitting .344 this spring. Are we looking at the opening day second baseman, Devin Travis, where the talk when they acquired him was, yeah, probably need some seasoning in AAA, but now with the injury to Asturias, are we looking at Devin Travis manning second base at Yankee Stadium beginning of April, Jeff?
That's who I would go with for sure. And the big question on Travis coming into the year, I think they knew he could hit at the major league caliber level, and Jim Leland and Brad Ausmus told John Gibbons that the big thing with him to watch was defense. And he's been pretty good defensively from watching him. And he's really impressed the manager, and he's really impressed his teammates. And I think you got to go with the upside on him versus someone like Goins, who was a black hole at the plate last year. And I think if Travis can play defense and he can add something offensively, I think that's the easy decision for them, because they really need something out of that spot. And if his tourist is down for an extended period, if it's not Travis, you're going with pretty much Goins every day. And I think that's too big of a risk after what happened last year. I think he's more suited for a backup role.
And a fine defensive replacement, no question, is Ryan Goins. Another guy that's opened eyes this spring and wasn't on a lot of people's radars even going into this spring training, but maybe should have been, because Alex Anthopoulos was singing his praises and had an idea he might have something in Miguel Castro, 6'5 guy who can light up the radar gun, high 90s, has what Anthopoulos described as a Fernando Rodney-like changeup, changing speeds. He can go 99, 89, 88, an 88-mile-an-hour changeup that has, you know, it's had major league hitters baffled here in spring training. I'd be surprised if he's not on this 25-man roster come opening day. Is that a risk, though, when you're talking about so much unproven talent? And yes, there is some talent there, and we've seen it already in spring training. If you're looking at a guy who has no major league service time in Miguel Castro, who hasn't pitched above A ball starting the season in the major leagues, you're looking at Daniel Norris, who had a cup of coffee at the major league level in September. He was a little banged up, had elbow problems, had some bone chips removed in the offseason. You're looking at Aaron Sanchez getting his first look at being a starter in the major leagues. You're looking at your second baseman never playing above a double A in Devin Travis. And you want to win the division. Does that seem like a recipe for success, Craig?
I mean, not traditionally. But I think it's basically you're looking at what you've got on hand. Like, you're looking at winning the division partly because there isn't a sure thing. It's not like you've got the Washington Nationals playing ahead of you and you've got five lights out starters. You've got a team, a division with a ton of question marks and a division with a ton of question marks. And I think basically in that way, you can, you know, cross your fingers and hope with some of these young guys, because without a massive trade coming in where you ship out young guys for current players, which isn't in the team's best interest, you've got no better options. And I think Castro is a guy who's, you know, pitched what, like six innings in spring training, but been lights out. Putting him into a situation where you're going to be yanking him up and down, if you're going to put him in the majors and then pull him down to double A and then, oh yeah, he's back. And then, oh, he's going to go. I don't think you want to do that with the guy, but if you're confident that the role you're going to put him in is a role that he can stick in, and basically, you know, don't try to make him do too much. Don't put him in a situation where he's going to fail miserably. I think you can, you know, do that with confidence and have him shore up your bullpen with his skill.
And if you don't use these guys, isn't that equally as big as a risk? If you're using Goins, and who would be the eighth inning guy, Looper?
Yeah, who knows? Steve Dellavar maybe bounce back after his season last year.
Yeah, and using Estrada in rotation, is that not a risk that they're just too underwhelming? And
well, yeah, I mean, that's a good point. On the one hand, you might be looking at a team, you know, that has babied its prospects in years previous, that is protected service time. Clearly, this is a season where they need to make the playoffs to save some jobs here. Alex Anthopoulos, John Gibbons are going to be out of town if they don't make the playoffs this year. Although I said that last year, they missed the playoffs, and both guys are back this year. So who knows? But it's a situation where you can't afford to let those guys get their bearings at AAA, get their first taste of high-level minor league baseball before bringing them north, because you have to win immediately. Mm-hmm. And we've seen how important starts can be. I mean, yeah, they play 162 games, but when you come down to the end of the season, it's always one or two games separating playoff teams from non-playoff teams. So you can't afford to get off to a slow start and work your way back. So it's important to make sure that you have your best team going north. And we've heard some of the veterans talking about how important that is, mm-hmm. and it not being the case in years previous. You've seen guys who are out of options being brought north because they're afraid of losing them. We're not going to have Kyle Drabek on this team in this bullpen because he's out of options. He might be able to slide through waivers either way, which is kind of an incredible precipitous drop from him. But I think we're going to see the best 25 guys with the best chance of making this a good team come north with this team come first game of the regular season.
I agree, and I don't feel like they're indiscriminately just bringing up the young guys and hoping for the best. Like, Osuna's looked great, too, in six innings of work. But he's going to get some seasoning. They're going to send him back down, and they're going to see what he's got. They're not just yanking him up and throwing him in there. So I feel like that's a confidence builder. You're not, you know, depleting your entire system all in one shot.
And from a starting rotation standpoint, it's the good balance they have is you got Dickey and Burley, who are almost locks for 200 innings.
Yeah.
So the upside of Sanchez and Norris, it's totally worth it, because if not them, then you're going to Estrada, or would it be Jeff Francis? Or
yeah.
Johan Santana?
Yeah, Johan Santana's kind of the forgotten man as well. Who knows if he can keep his arm attached here for a couple of starts and maybe work his way into the conversation come May. Could be a nice luxury to have. There's no risk involved in signing him, and we haven't heard anything about him. I don't even know where he is as far as rehabbing that shoulder injury, but we haven't heard anything about him. He hasn't appeared in any spring training games yet. I don't think he's appeared in any minor league spring training games either. Overall, though, as we approach the start of the regular season, has the outlook for this team changed now with Stroman out and all the information that we have? Does it still look like maybe a 1-2 with them and the Red Sox? Or do we think that they are, I mean, there's just too many injuries, too many question marks for them to be considered among the favorites in the American League East, Jeff?
I still think they should be considered among the favorites. I don't think there's mostly just because of the division. And I think they've solved some of their questions with some of these young guys emerging, or at least potentially emerging. But I still think there's too many questions at the bottom of the roster, and there's still some depth questions, and will the bullpen hold up? And at the top of the roster, they're as good as anyone, almost in baseball. But it's a 25-man team, and there's going to be injuries. So they've already had their fair share, and you know there's going to be more. But in terms of the AL East, I think they have to be considered in the conversation.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, the top of their batting order is absolutely insane. So you can at least sort of, barring injury to Jose Reyes or whomever, they have a really, really deep batting lineup. And then, yeah, like you said, the back of the lineup is the thing that you worry about. But in terms of bona fides in that division right now, you're not getting a ton. Like, even the Rays had the best pitching staff until guys started getting injured, right? So you're looking at a lot of question marks all over the division.
It's the Blue Jays and Phillies this afternoon, 12:30 on Sportsnet 590, the Fan, a little spring training action. When we come back, the Raptors now 0-3 against the Bulls this season after a 108-92 loss yesterday. They've got the horrible, terrible New York Knicks in town tomorrow, although they lost their last meeting at MSG. What's going on with the Raptors these days? We will discuss coming up next. I'm Ben Annis alongside Jeff Simmons and Craig Battle. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
If it's a sports story you're talking about, you can guarantee they'll be talking about it. Unless it's something like arena football. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590. The Fan.
Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Annis alongside Craig Battle and Jeff Simmons. Raptors lose 108-92 in Chicago yesterday to the Bulls, falling to fourth in the Eastern Conference. They are 0-3 against Chicago this year. They've got one more crack at them On Wednesday, Bulls come to town for the final time this season. We are winding down the regular season, and we know the Raptors are going to win the Atlantic Division, which means they will, quote-unquote, finish fourth in the East, although they can potentially not have home court advantage in that first-round series. And the Washington Wizards are now just 1 point back, or one game back of them in the Eastern Conference. So the Raptors have been very inconsistent recently. Last few weeks, they went on that brutal 9-loss-out-of-10-game stretch. They beat Indiana, looked pretty good. I mean, they hung on for a win over Minnesota, but there has not been a moment where we've said, oh, this team is back to being what it was early this year. Does that mean that we will never get there again, Craig? Is that it? I mean, is this what the Raptors are right now? Has the league figured them out?
I think, yeah, the closest you're going to get to they're back was that Indiana game. Indiana at that point had been completely streaking, sort of setting up a late season playoff push, potentially getting Paul George back. So that was big. I don't think we're getting back the streaking, superb offense, top two, top one, whatever it was for that whole month and a half there. They started the season absolutely on fire, fourth quarter efficiency through the roof. And that, I don't think, is coming back. I don't think we're going to see that. I think the team's banged up enough. And the team, I think, hasn't made the adjustments that they would need to make. So they're being guarded more strategically. The teams know that they're looking for their one-on-one opportunities in certain situations, and they're getting out in front of them. So the shots get tougher. But the shots aren't changing. And I think that's something that the Raptors really need to sort of figure out or own up to by the end of this season. A one-on-one, mid-range J turnaround isn't the best shot in the NBA. And every other team in the NBA is avoiding that shot. And the Raptors seem stuck in doing that on offense way too much. DeRozan and Lowry and Vasquez, they can, the guys who should be swinging the ball, the guys who should be facilitating the offense, like turning double teams into open looks for others, aren't doing it.
And my issue with the team isn't even the offense, it's the defense. And the defense has been horrible. They give up far too many easy baskets. And what are they, 69 games into the season? It's hard to imagine just the light bulb coming on and them figuring out how to play defense all of a sudden. And if you can't play defense in the playoffs, they're going to get exposed. And they give up easy baskets far too frequently. I don't know if it's an effort level or if they're just coasting because their division stinks so much. But their defensive play just consistently is a huge issue. And the easy baskets are just, they're so concerning to me.
We saw it last night in that loss to the Bulls where, you know, you get a guy on the perimeter, even someone like Mike Dunleavy or Nikola Mirotic or Tony Snell, not guys who are obviously known for being massive, you know, breakdowns waiting to happen, not John Wall or Kyrie Irving or something in the house. They're doing an up fake and just straight line driving right to the hoop. The team's perimeter defense is not something that they should write home about, but their help defense on the back end isn't great either. So when you don't have guys who can step up and who are sort of cognizant of where everybody else is on the floor, they're constantly looking for the rotation and not looking for the ball handler.
So what the hell happened? Because this team was a good defensive team a year ago. They had some great battles midway through the season when they started to figure it out. I think the turning point for me was that game against the Pacers last year where it was just a slugfest. You had a couple of great defensive teams playing against each other. They smothered teams with their defense. And it's not an entire, you know, the whole roster hasn't been turned over since then, a year ago. Why is it so lousy? Are we not, I know everybody loves Dwayne Casey and he's a nice guy and he's easy to get along with and he sounds great on the radio and on TV and he says all the right things. But should there be more fingers pointed his direction, Craig?
I think, yeah, the failure to make adjustments. It doesn't seem like this team has the athletes to run the defensive system that they're running now, which involves trapping and recovering at a really high level, whereas everybody else is moving to the Chicago Bulls, Tom Thibodeau, let's pack the paint and make this easy on ourselves as possible, right? But I don't understand your question still salient. Why, what changed? Like, it's not like this is a radically different thing than they were doing a year ago. And it seems like last night, Lowry and DeRozan both seem to point to the fact that it's a bit of an effort thing, that perhaps they're looking ahead when they shouldn't be, that they don't have anything left to win, right? Whereas I feel like home court advantage is a massive boon to this team. Like starting in the ACC in front of the We the North fans and that sort of energy, I feel like if they lose that to Washington and they wind up starting on the road, that's going to be a much bigger thing for them to come over than they think. And yeah, like I just want to see this team for their own sake get better over these last 10, 11 games, right?
And bad defense gets exposed in the playoffs all the time.
Yep.
And it's not like this is new to Dwayne Casey. Even when they were playing well, he kept talking about how the defense was concerning, which almost makes the lack of adjustments or the fact that the team hasn't adjusted even more of an issue, because if they can't adjust over this big of a stretch, how are they going to adjust in a playoff series? And in playoffs, adjustments are so important. And they kind of struggled with that their last go-around in Brooklyn. You saw the veteran team until later in the Game 7. They really had trouble with that veteran Nets team. And frankly, they're not that good of a team. And now you're going to play probably maybe the Wizards or the Bucks. If they're not playing good defense, those are teams that can score. And it's hard to even think they're going to win a first-round series the way they're playing right now.
Yeah, I mean, if Aaron Brooks and Tony Snell are breaking you down off the dribble, like John Wall and Bradley Beal are going to eat you alive.
And you see it every time they play a good team. They get exposed. Maybe not the Cleveland game they had a couple weeks ago, but it's on Chicago, and every time they play one of those Western powers, they just... they beat them easily.
Yeah.
I think that all comes back to defense.
Yeah, but it's just a recent thing, right? Like they've had, it wasn't that long ago they were beating the Hawks in that first game post All-Star break by a ton, and they've had big wins over good teams. I know they beat a Grizzlies team that was missing a bunch of guys due to the flu, but I mean, Zebo was there. Gasol was still in the lineup when they beat him at the Air Canada Center. They played some good teams tight. They beat the Cavs when they, I guess, weren't necessarily the Cavs early this season, but there are good wins. They've owned the Clippers this year. It's not a bad team. The Clippers,
they can't play defense either.
And the Clippers bench is questionable. They took the Blazers to overtime and probably should have won that game in Portland. I don't know if it's easy enough to say they are a good Eastern Conference team. They beat up on Eastern Conference teams who are mediocre. They've beaten good teams. They're just an inconsistent team, Craig.
Yeah, then that's what makes this team frustrating. If they were a mediocre team who, could beat bad teams,
they're hard to figure out.
They're really hard to figure out. They've had signature wins in this season, and they've looked fantastic in stretches. Even, winning 3 of 4, Minnesota isn't anybody's, juggernaut. But they beat Minnesota. They beat Miami. They beat Indiana. So, yeah, like, Miami and Indiana are potential playoff teams as well, right? So the fact that they've had these wins and they go through these stretches where they look like they're figuring out, where they look like they're getting points from their back end, they're getting contributions from their bench there, where Jonas Valanciunas goes with a couple of double-doubles in a row and he's averaging 14 and 12 over a week, these moments they feel like they should be built on rather than built on and then disappear. I think that's an amazing thing for this team, and it's something they're going to have to figure out. And whether it is an effort issue or whether it is Blake Murphy, Rappers Republic, says on Twitter that it's tough for a team to figure out how to regain chemistry when they never really understood it in the first place, right? Like this team, at the deadline, they kept talking about him. Saji Ujiri kept talking about it. We don't want to upset the amazing chemistry, the balance that we've got on this team. The guys really pull for each other, and it's one of those likable teams where it does seem like everybody knows his role and wants to play for the other guy. But how that actually sort of manifests and how you regain it when it disappears is a whole other story.
They need to go on one of those retreats or something where they need to do some trust falls. I don't know what it is. But it does seem like this team was able to survive without DeMar DeRozan for an extended period of time. And maybe they weren't as dynamic and as great as they were when they were winning 13 of the first 15 games this season or whatever it was. But they were still a good team and hanging in there with some good teams. That game in Portland mentioned, wins over the Clippers without DeMar DeRozan. Kyle Lowry goes down, though, and it's an entirely different scenario. And part of it, I guess, is only having two true point guards on this team. So you got to put Lou Williams a little bit more in that distributor role. Which he's been okay at. But another aspect is, just frankly, Kyle Lowry's more important piece to this team than DeMar DeRozan. How much of this second half swoon has, you know, something to do with Kyle Lowry's play, not just now that he's out, even though he dressed yesterday, but diminished play ever since the All-Star break, Jeff.
And he was carrying the team when DeRozan was out.
Yeah.
And at some point you wonder if his body wore out a little bit, because he was playing so well when DeRozan was out, and they really stepped up well in his absence. A lot of people filled up in roles they haven't really been in. And since DeRozan came back, Lowry he hasn't been the same player that he was early in the season. He's been sat out a couple times with injuries, and you wonder if maybe he used too much, and they have to keep him healthy for the playoffs, because if he's not going, they don't have a chance.
No, it's interesting. So yeah, Lowry obviously dominated for the 2014 portion of this season and hasn't been quite himself. The triple double last week or the week ago notwithstanding. So he's a good rebounder for a guard, which often gets a point guard despite his size. He gambles a bit on defense. He gets blown by like everybody else in this team. But the energy level is always there with him. And I think that's a boon for any team. And he has the capability to completely go on fire. So yeah, having, you know, healthy, confident Kyle Lowry back on the floor as soon as possible is key, for not only a stretch run, but for the playoffs. And another guy that, seems to have gone AWOL and not through his own fault is James Johnson.
Yeah.
Like early in the season, especially when DeRozan was out, he was just magic, right? Like he was getting on the floor. He was getting the ball to the hoop, which everybody else seems to shy away from. When he's not on the floor, they don't get a lot of line drives. He's a great finisher around the basket, one of the best in the NBA, good defender, doesn't stretch the floor, which it seems like the team genuinely worries about, because that's the only reason I can see him being on the bench for as long as he is. He's a better defender than anybody else they have at the small forward spot. He's got so many bona fides and so many good reasons for him to be on the floor, and he's just not. And I really wonder why that's the case.
Yeah, it seems like they really do want Terrence Ross to stretch the floor and take those threes. That's why he's back in the starting lineup. Mm-hmm. Although, and I know James Johnson's only shooting 23% from three this season, but it feels like he's hit a couple of big ones this season.
It's clutch.
Yeah, it seems like he hits the clutch three. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Craig Battle and Jeff Simmons. What's going on with Jonas Valanciunas? It's the question that won't disappear, won't go anywhere. The guy had one field goal attempt yesterday, and granted, that was a blowout. Maybe it was an anomaly, but he still does not get the playing time. He missed the entire second quarter. Dwayne Casey sat him out after a dominating opening quarter against the T-Wolves on Wednesday. They win by 5 points. But he looked like he was going to be able to carve up the defense all game long, and was doing so in the opening quarter. Didn't play the rest of the half after the opening 12 minutes. We know he doesn't play in the last 5 minutes of any game. He is young. But I don't know. Are we not asking the right questions? I just wish there was some answer. I just wish I could... even like some conceivable answer as to why it's not happening for Jonas Valanciunas. Craig, help me out here.
I feel like something that the team sees that they don't necessarily like about Jonas, and that he hasn't been picking up on quite as quickly as he could, is the help defense and the rotations and stuff like that. What we were talking about before with straight line drives to the hoop and easy buckets and stuff like that, that's partly on your center. That's partly on Valanciunas.
Sure. Right?
So... especially late in games, I feel like they don't look for him on offense. So he's kind of, you know, whether that's his fault or not, they don't look for him. He doesn't get the ball. So he's essentially a minus on offense. And if he's not rotating and he's not, you know, defending the way you want.
They don't like his pick and roll defense.
They don't like his rotations, which from everything I've seen have gotten better over his tenure with the Raptors, but aren't where they want him to be. But whether they should have been trotting him out there game after game during that early season, because we've talked about it before, this team has essentially had a first seed in the Atlantic Division sewn up since about November, December. Hardly any team in this division was trying. Like Boston actually is making a surprise run at the playoffs. But yeah, nobody saw that coming. This was a free playoff spot in the fourth seed since the beginning. Why it wasn't the goal of the season to make sure guys stay rested. You know, like, beat the teams we've got to beat. Make sure Lowry.
See what you have in Valanciunas.
See what you got in Valanciunas. You know, see what our best combinations are. Like, experiment a bit. You know, like, you know, we've got chemistry. You know, these guys like each other. They're all playing. Let's experiment a bit. We talked about this before in the NHL thing. And, I mean, this team has had carte blanche. They could go out against teams and sort of, you know, we don't mind if Jonas Valanciunas plays 12 minutes tonight, because we're going to try to teach him. We're going to make this a teachable moment. And we're also going to show him that you can make mistakes and not get immediately yanked, because we've seen that hurt young players before. We've seen that, you know, like the lack of confidence be a death knell for young players.
And it all comes back to the interior defense thing, but how is he going to get better by not playing in those situations, the high leverage moments of the game?
Yeah.
And I guess Casey's more comfortable with Patrick Patterson in that role. But you got to develop this guy. And by babying him, it might not be the best point, because that's the big question with him, is the interior defense. And you're not going to learn by sitting and watching every night. And at this point in the season where they're kind of treading water, you might as well see what you got there. And if that can boost your team down the stretch,
yeah,
why not take that chance?
I feel like I keep bringing it back to Dwayne Casey, but I feel like there's a reason I do it. He's the head coach of this team. He's supposed to be in charge of what happens on the offensive end, on the defensive end, from a scheme standpoint. If Jonas Valanciunas isn't getting the ball enough, if Jonas Valanciunas, his development has been stunted by, I would say, partly no fault of his own. Yeah, part of it is, yeah, he hasn't developed maybe as well defensively as you would have liked. But when he's only getting the ball in his hands a couple of times a game, when you're sitting him for entire quarters, when you're playing him sparingly, when you refuse to play him in the final 5 minutes of the game, that's on the head coach. I mean, there's no other way to look at that. How will he be evaluated? Dwayne Casey, we know, okay, the goal is to win a playoff series for this team, and if they do that, this season will be regarded as a success. Isn't that kind of a scary thing, though, Craig? Because if they get the Bucks in the first round, they beat the Milwaukee Bucks, who have slid down the Eastern Conference standings ever since the trade deadline, and you get your doors blown off by whoever, Chicago, Cleveland, Washington in the second round, and you're going to evaluate this whole thing as being a successful season. Isn't that a scary situation? Or is Masai Ujiri too smart for that? Does he realize that there's some serious problems with this team and it doesn't really have the foundation of a championship contender as currently constructed?
I think there's always danger in sort of saying, oh yeah, if we do this, we'll be happy. Like last year for the Jays, it was meaningful games in August, and that did not work out when they started a 10-game losing streak. The bar is always changing. If you get embarrassed in the second round and exposed as, you know, having a supreme dearth of talent in comparison to the Cavaliers or the Chicago Bulls, and your young guys, because at a certain point, the young team that you've built stops being regarded as unlimited potential and starts being regarded as the players that they actually are. And they're not that young anymore. It's not like you're dealing with a Philadelphia 76ers 19-year-old team. Right. If they can win that first round series, you know, which is a big F, you know, like if they get Washington, they beat Washington a couple of times this year. So that's not the worst matchup in the world for them, even though they've got talent. Milwaukee's beat them. Their length scares them. So it's not like that first round series is a cakewalk. And even if you did get through that, I don't think getting embarrassed in the second round is anybody's idea of a big success.
Yeah, they need to show legitimate progress for the season really to be successful. Whether that's not always a first round win, that's a bit too arbitrary to just say this is what makes our season successful. I think they want to take a step forward from the, because last year seemed like a bit of a fluke, but when they came out at the beginning of the year and they looked like it was for real, they were supposed to jump maybe to the next level and maybe some development from Ross. That hasn't happened. DeRozan and Lowry are playing well, but they're not. They haven't really jumped the team to the next level. And the playoffs are really where you're going to see what this team is.
Right.
And maybe that's why they've kind of been so laissez-faire and they just want to get to the playoffs.
Sure. And the next step for this team, they've got free agency in front of them. They've got a bunch of guys coming up, but it doesn't seem like they're a piece away anymore. It doesn't seem like they're like, oh yeah, we're going to get a starting power forward and a backup center, and that's going to fix us. Like, you know, they've got question marks all through the lineup at this point right now, and they seem like they're a defensive system and an offensive system away. Like they don't have a lot of sure things coming in next season. They're going to be a an okay team that has to make a lot of moves.
All right, here's the question. Is Dwayne Casey the head coach of this team when they are good? Is he the head coach of this team to turn them into that team that is among the elite in the Eastern Conference, battling for a spot in the NBA Finals? Is Dwayne Casey that guy standing on the sidelines, Greg?
Yeah, I have questions about Dwayne Casey's ability to be that guy who can coach the other guy, the best other guy. Like, so we've got, you know, in the annals of basketball history, you've got your Phil Jacksons and your Pat Rileys, and these guys really excelled at next level strategy and making adjustments and stuff like that. And that doesn't necessarily seem like what Dwayne Casey has been good. Jeff pointed out earlier that he's had all season to address certain issues that keep popping up, you know, like a lack of ball movement and the questionable shot making and the porous defense and stuff like that. And none of these things seem to have been addressed from like a system standpoint. So yeah, there's those coaches who excel at taking ill-fitting parts or young guys and turning them into a good team. And then that same coach doesn't always excel at turning a good team into a great one. And I'm not sure, I hope Dwayne Casey can prove me wrong, but I don't see him being the guy who can turn a good team into a great team.
Yeah, in hockey, there was always the Roger Nielsen. He would always set these teams up, turn them around, and then someone else would come in and take them to the next level. He can never figure that out. At some point, I wonder, maybe that's Casey's. And Casey's, his strength, he's really good at his strength. He commands the room very well. The players respect him, and he really did a good job last year. And Masai Ujiri, this wasn't his hire, but he seems to really be comfortable with the job he's done. But the team keeps treading around, they're not really adjusting. At some point, you have to wonder, is this the guy that's really going to make us a championship level team? And it's too early to say that, but if they maintain on this path, they're going to have to do something at some point, and they're going to need a fresh voice in there to really, maybe a more of a strategy guy, as Craig pointed out, because that's not a strength of Casey, or at least it doesn't appear that way, for them to really become a championship level team.
If that is the case, though, will it take a moment? Will Masai Ujiri need a moment where it's losing in the first round, where he can point to that and say, that's why the head coach is fired, that's why we're looking for a new head coach right now? Or can he justify firing a guy if they do win a first round series, no matter what happens in the second round? Does he need justification to fire Dwayne Casey? Because we know he likes him at least a little bit. Does Masai Ujiri need a reason? If that is the case, and if he truly believes what we're talking about, that Dwayne Casey's not that next level coach, does Masai Ujiri need a moment to point to?
Absolutely not. He's the honcho of this team. If he doesn't feel comfortable with the coach, for him it's a little different. He's got to sell it to the board, so maybe he needs a reason for them.
Yeah.
But I remember in football, the Chargers fired their coach after a 14-2 season.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This, if he's not comfortable, Dwayne Casey, I don't think he needs a reason or a moment. He's gone.
I think it'll be a slightly tougher sell based on the fact that Dwayne Casey has 2 years left in his deal. He signed a 3-year.
That's just money.
They're paying Nathan Horton 5 years.
That's right.
I don't think the MLSC cares about that.
But the other thing, I think it won't necessarily be a moment that you need, but it will be, you're going to have to sell it as who's available. If Tom Thibodeau of Chicago is available after the season, which seems to me absolutely insane, why Chicago would ever let Tom Thibodeau go. But let's say that happens. You want Tom Thibodeau coaching your team, so you could sell a coaching change in favor of getting a defensive genius who's carried the injured Bulls to playoffs after playoffs after playoffs, despite the fact that you keep having to compensate for the lack of Derrick Rose in your lineup and when the entire offense was built around him. So yeah, if you have a coaching hire that is a slam dunk, you can easily sell a coaching change.
Andrew Wiggins came to town for the first time last week, and he got in a little bit of foul trouble, especially in that first half. Finished with 5. Did have 15 points and 6 of 9 shooting, 3 rebounds, no assists though. I was kind of expecting more of a reaction to Andrew Wiggins. Honestly, I thought he would get a bit more of an ovation. Kind of reserved crowd in Toronto. It was cool to see him and all the hoopla surrounding that. What did you make of Andrew Wiggins' return to Toronto, Craig?
I find it's interesting that we're sort of that the Toronto media is going through this hindering. I'm not sure what it is, but it's like we're already cheering for a guy who's like 5 years away at best, you know, like we're not trading for Wiggins. We're not giving up Wiggins. And yet it's sort of, we're already planning the victory parade for when we get Wiggins and we win the title. It's sort of an interesting thing. Like the guy's potential is off the charts. He's probably the rookie of the year. His impact this season is fantastic. He's gone from being a massive bust in November to being, you know, the surefire rookie of the year. All these things are great. He's a hometown guy. But I feel like a slightly muted response is probably right. We like you. You're from Thornhill. You're not a Raptor yet. We're not going to cheer for you that well.
But he is a Toronto guy, and he's going to be rookie of the year, Jeff.
See, I expected a bigger reaction in the crowd. The big reaction almost came from the media. Do you see on those scrums that he had?
Yeah.
They're crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Almost Sam Mitchell almost got a bigger reaction from the fans. He was the head coach that night. And when Wiggins, you kind of want to see a bigger buzz. This is a homegrown superstar.
I thought it was going to be a big deal.
Oh, so did I. I was a little surprised, a little underwhelmed.
I saw a ton of buzz, though. Like you said, like in the media.
But
like
in the media, not from the crowd.
Yeah. It did seem kind of a muted crowd. And we know they can get into it down at the Air Canada Center.
Sure.
For the Raptors, not for the Leafs.
But. Yeah. Well, he's just not the North yet, right?
Yeah,
you know,
right.
Yeah, like they're a partisan crowd there, you know, he's still the enemy.
But if there was free pizza.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. There's free pizza, yeah.
And part of it might be that he's kind of a muted star himself. He doesn't exactly get you jacked up. He's a very quiet guy. Seems like a nice kid, but very quiet, although does most of the talking with his play, which has been very good in his brief NBA career. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about the madness and that head coach who fell off his stool after his son hit the game-winning three for Georgia State. Also, Chris Borland, the former San Francisco 49ers linebacker, retiring at 24 because he's afraid of concussions. Hard to blame him. How does this affect the future of the NFL? And Milos Raonic, is this a huge stepping stone in his career, beating Rafa Nadal for the first time ever after an 0-5 start yesterday at Indian Wells? All that and plenty more coming up next. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Craig Battle and Jeff Simmons on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Sportsnet Magazine's 25 greatest NHL games of all time is like nothing you've experienced before. A fully interactive magazine planned and executed entirely as a digital adventure. It's available free to everyone with a tablet or phone. We polled NHL insiders, historians, and fans to reach our definitive ranking. These are the iconic moments, epic comebacks, massive brawls, marathon games, and legendary performances that live in hockey lore. To get the 25 greatest NHL games of all time, find us on Next Issue or download the Sportsnet Magazine app from iTunes and Google Play. Then, start swiping your way through history. History. Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I am Ben Ennis alongside Craig Battle and Jeff Simmons. I got a couple of minutes here before the top of the hour. I will be joined by Grievous Vasquez, Raptors point guard, coming up at 12 o'clock as we get set for Blue Jays baseball. Blue Jays and Philadelphia Phillies from nearby Clearwater to Dunedin. Blue Jays winding down their Grapefruit League schedule.
Toronto.
Oh, my God. I just had a heart attack. Yes, Raptors basketball will take place at some point as well. March Madness rolling right along. There's already been some moments, and maybe one of the all-time moments in the history of this tournament, as number 14 Georgia State beating number 3 Baylor, and the coach who tore his Achilles tendon in the final game of the tournament that got them into the field of 64, he tore up his Achilles in the celebration. So it was on the sidelines on a stool that was on wheels, had a cast. His son hits the game-winning three with 2 seconds to go, falls off the chair onto the court. They hang on to win. I mean, is that a top five moment in the tournament? I mean, it happens in the first round. We see upsets all the time. I mean, that's part of it as well. It was a 14 over a 3.
Yep.
It's Baylor, but it's a 14 over the 3. It's Georgia State. I mean, where does that rank for you, Craig?
It's one of the cooler things I've seen, especially the 3 was hit by his son from about 6 feet out.
Yeah.
And, wheels on the chair were evidently a bad idea.
Yes.
But, he lost control of his body and flops right onto the floor. He's sort of, he's anxious. He can't get up. He's got no Achilles, That to me was just such a cool moment, the guy's overcome with emotion so much that he literally falls out of his chair on the sideline of a basketball game. And, in a way, sort of as an avatar for the fans watching, the entire, Sportsnet magazine newsroom. Yeah, exactly. He was us. The newsroom was blowing up so much that the art department, who were slaving away on the magazine, were shocked. They all, started because we all went nuts. It was a fantastic moment.
It was a very cool moment, and it's been a tournament filled with upsets. Now, yesterday wasn't as much as Thursday, but I think ESPN now has one dude. There's one guy still with the perfect bracket of the whatever 50 million that they have filling out the brackets. Also, we should mention big news yesterday coming out of the NBA as we circle back just a little bit. Kevin Durant looks like he's going to be done for the season for the Oklahoma City Thunder. Now, Russell Westbrook's maybe been the most exciting player in the NBA over the last few weeks. It was 5 triple-doubles in 6 games, 4 straight. He was unbelievable. He's the fastest. He's got the ability to get to the rim like nobody else maybe in the NBA. If there's one guy right now you might plunk down money to go see, it is him. And they are in a playoff spot right now. 2 games up on the New Orleans Pelicans. At 39-30, but Jeff, if they make the playoffs, that's one thing, but they were expected to be a title contender, even if they came out of the 8th seed, as long as Kevin Durant came back and was healthy. If he's gone for the rest of the season, can we just write them off?
I don't know if you can write them off, just Westbrook's played so well this season, but it looks like they're going to play the Warriors in the first round, and without Durant, that's become so much tougher for them, and they got such good guards in Golden State, and they would have needed a guy like Durant in that series. And
kind of takes the pressure off, though, because they're not regarded now as a title contender anymore.
Yeah, that's true. And that would have been such a good 8-1 series if Durant was there. And that makes it so much tougher on them. I think Golden State, that's a huge thing for them. And I don't know if you can count them out necessarily, but I think that's a huge blow.
And Ibaka is injured, too, for Oklahoma City. So it's not like the rest of the team is all, set and going. They've got, they traded for Deion Waiters for no apparent reason. I feel like that is, it's got to be Golden State, wiping the sweat off their brow, being like, okay, this is a much easier story. But wouldn't that have been a classic 1-8 series?
Oh, it would have been great.
If you could have had Durant and Westbrook going up against the Splash Brothers and, I don't know. I feel cheated a little bit. And obviously I don't know the half of what Kevin Durant's feeling, but it feels to me like the series lacks so much intrigue now.
It's kind of crazy. We could be talking about a team that, if things don't go well next year, will not have won a title. And who knows if Durant re-signs there, but I mean, they had James Harden, Kevin Durant, and Russell Westbrook all at the same time, didn't win a title. Had a deep playoff run, but didn't win a title. Looks like they're not going to win a title this year. Who knows about the future of Kevin Durant as a basketball player, a viable guy? Because, you're talking about a foot here with screws and all kinds of surgeries on it. If you're a big guy and you got foot problems, that's not exactly great. It's not like I would take Greg Oden over him or anything, but, it could be a troublesome future in OKC and with Kevin Durant.
I was actually having a debate the other day, and I asked, would you rather be a team like Oklahoma City that competes every year but never wins? Or would you rather be someone like the Blue Jays that won twice and then did nothing for 20 years?
Well, I guess it's when will they win again? I mean, if you win your 2 titles and then that's it, you never win again?
Yeah, or you're good for 15 years and you don't win.
It's a tough one. I think I'd take the 15 years. I think there's something to be said for sustained, high level of play, even if you haven't won title. I think they've had a good run there in Oklahoma City. I think they've enjoyed watching that basketball team the last few years.
Yeah, I mean, they drafted so well in that, and they lucked out, of course, getting Kevin Durant at 2. There was such a no-brainer pick, and he worked out as well or better than they'd hoped. They got Russell Westbrook, which was kind of a shrewd four pick. They got James Harden as a no-brainer two pick. They got Ibaka in the 20s. And so all four of those picks were perfect, were amazing. They fit together really well. But they're a team that suffers because, unlike MLSC, they can't eat money.
Like, yeah,
they don't have the flexibility. They signed Scott Brooks to a contract. They're keeping Scott Brooks. They signed Kendrick Perkins. There's no way they're going to use the amnesty to make the room for James Harden. So they had to trade James Harden. They picked between Ibaka and Harden, and they thought, okay, well, we've got scoring. We've got small forward and point guard locked up, so we don't need this guy as much as we need Ibaka's defense, right? There was no, we're going to keep them both and pay it into the luxury tax. That wasn't a consideration for them, and that's got to be frustrating. And I mean, the Thunder fans are probably tired of hearing about it, but that's an awful thing to be that close.
To the NFL, where Chris Borland retires at the age of 24, linebacker with the San Francisco 49ers. He was slated to be a starter this season, but he's afraid of CTE and concussions and thinking about his long-term health. A lot of people have pontificated as to whether this will have an effect on the long-term future of the NFL, or kids in high school deciding to pick up the game, or parents deciding, hey, you know what, I'm not going to have my kid play this game. Jeff, where do you come down on that? Is this the beginning of the end of the NFL, Chris Borland deciding to retire?
No, hyperbole really was a little nuts this week. And you have to applaud Borland, but I think with him, it's a different case. I think there's a lot more guys who are more willing to take the risk of, and they know they need the money, and they come out of tough areas, or they need the education. And
not Chris Borland, though. It comes from money, and he's going to be just fine.
He's a different case. I think the information is out there more than it ever used to be, and you see all the CTE stuff with some of the older players. But there's a lot more situations of guys who didn't have CTE, and there's a lot more players that are going to keep playing. After Borland's stuff came out, Bobby Wagner, the Seahawks middle linebacker, went on Twitter and said, well, he respects Borland's decision. There's no way he would ever consider doing that. He wants to play football and be the best middle linebacker in the league. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot more Bobby Wagners than there are Chris Borlands. I don't see the end of football coming by any means.
Yeah, I can see parents not putting their kids into Pop Warner or whatever because they're worried, but, you know, those parents are likely to have other options, like, oh, you know, my son really likes playing soccer, or I'm going to force him to basketball or baseball or something like that. But if you're in a, like, that's likely not to happen too much in Texas, where, you know, football is life. You know, Texas kids are going to keep coming up. And so I see, you know, it happening on a smaller level. But for a lot of, like, superstars, we're not going to see Aaron Rodgers, you know, hang him up tomorrow saying, I'm worried about the concussions, guys. I'm going to forego my $20 million a year. It's not going to happen.
Yeah, he doesn't take enough hits to be among those guys that concerned probably about CTE. The BNP Paribas Open continues at Indian Wells today. Sportsnet 1, you can watch the semifinals starting at 2 o'clock. It starts with Novak Djokovic against Andy Murray, and the match after that will be Milos Raonic against Roger Federer after Raonic took care of Rafa Nadal yesterday in three sets. Maybe the biggest win of his career so far. He was 0-5 against Nadal, headed into yesterday's match, beat him to advance to the semifinals of what people call the fifth Grand Slam. It's a big tournament at Indian Wells. Is it just a blip on the radar for Raonic, or could this be the start of an incredible season for Canada's best male tennis player, Craig?
I think it's a good moment, and it's a nice thing for him. But I think Nadal's sort of, you know, between his knee injuries and, you know, his advanced age for tennis anyway, he's on the way down on his career, and Raonic is still on the way up. You know, like, he's still developing the game that adds to his insane serve, which was working yesterday and helped him get over Nadal. But at the same point, he's still, Raonic wins and gets to play his nemesis,
yes,
Roger Federer, in the semis. So it's not like, you know, it was a tournament ender. Like, it was the final, and he won the 1,000-point ATP tour. Yeah, man, that would be amazing. And you could sort of feel like you could already chalk it up as a massive win for his season. But, yeah, he still got to beat Federer to get to the final.
And before we go, Major League Baseball announcing the other day that they will start every game at the same time on the final day of the regular season. They're all going to start at 3 o'clock, which is something I hadn't thought about, but something that seems pretty cool, where you could have an incredible finish, Jeff, and you could have all these teams battling for playoff spots, and they're all going to matter because there's the result, the the goal will not be decided before you even take the field on that last day of the season.
Yeah, that was a genius idea. And you've been talking about March Madness. It's the ultimate viewer's experience. And for baseball, that's perfect, especially if there's a race at the end of the year. There was one day a couple of years ago where the Red Sox, the Yankees, and the Rays, they were all playing. All those games were going on at the same time, and Longoria hit the home run, and one of the games was delayed. If you can get one of those again, that was one of the better sports TV nights I've ever seen.
Maybe we'll have to figure it out at Sportsnet where we get the 12 double boxes. You know, you can all watch them all on one TV screen. Thanks a lot, gents. When we come back, I will be joined by Raptors point guard Grievous Vasquez. We'll talk about yesterday's game in Chicago, loss to the Bulls. Also look forward to what this team needs to change to get back to where they were earlier this season. This has been Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Craig Battle and Jeff Simmons on the Sportsnet Radio Network.